And it's good to be back, and I truly appreciate that you perhaps have come back as well to join me for the next hour or so of discussion about all things art and comic related. I know the time gap between interviews has been extended in the past year or so, and that's really putting it mildly, but that's only a result of my available time for this webcast being shortened as well. You know, you're busy with family and stuff, and I'm no different. I've been busy with family working some exciting comic projects as well. But rest assured, though, that I have not forgotten the Boing Podcast, and whenever I can reserve some free time for it, you know I will do so. Before we dive right into this month's interview, we need to break with a message from one of our many, many exciting sponsors. We'll be right back.
Ah, chili dogs with the wings. You're the best, Rosie.
You betcha, Mr. J.
Ah, boy.
Oh, that will...
Jane!
New Tums Quick Pack. Dissolves instantly.
George, what is it?
Heartburn's gone.
Never mind.
New Tums Quick Pack. Bring it on.
Mountain Dew, the new soft drink with that real mountain flavor. Mountain Dew, it'll tickle your innards.
As I continue to explore possible guests for this webcast, I'm quickly reminded that many of the living legends in the funny animal comics and cartoons genre are not always easily accessible or have the desire to be accessible, and that really makes for quite a challenge. I'm also reminded, though, that this show is not just about those legends. It's also about up-and-comers, current talent, and future legends. Discovering these amazing artists and cartooning geniuses is not an exact science, that's for sure. You know, I seem to bump into many of my favorite guests by accident, either it's on the web or by word of mouth. Today's guest is no exception. He came to my attention only recently, and this is really embarrassing to admit because he's been writing and illustrating for quite some time now. Mark Siegel first came to my attention when I was enjoying a podcast from a friend of mine, Bruce Rosenberger, over at comicscast.libsyn.com, and I'll give you a link to his podcast later. He gave a quick review of a webcomic, soon to be released as a graphic novel on October 5th, entitled Sailor Twain. And he described how it was not only well-written, but his use of charcoals as the story's medium was simply beautiful to look at. My interest was piqued, so I had to go have a look. After the first 10 pages, I was hooked. It was like eye candy to me. I opted to stop there, though, because I knew the graphic novel was coming out soon, and for those that don't want to wait, though, the story can be read and viewed from start to finish at sailortwain.com. Mark is known both as an author and a writer, as well as the editorial director at First Second Books, which publishes graphic novels for all ages. Mark's background in art is deep and diverse, and I was fortunate enough to talk to him for a while about his experiences, also his processes and his use of charcoals, as well as his latest project, Sailor Twain. Here now is Mark Siegel. Take us back to when you were just a young illustrating genius, and tell us where you were raised and how you got this bug for drawing and writing and where it all started.
So I was raised in France. And my dad's American, my mom's French, so I had both backgrounds, but I was in France, so I grew up with that tradition of comics, And basically, as far back as I can remember, I was always writing and drawing, and those two in combination, of course, are kind of ideal in comics. And then I got going. I was exposed to some of the great French comics, like the people like Mobius, Hugo Pratt, a bunch of others that some of whom I got to meet as a teenager and get some coaching on my own projects, which was exciting. I was apprenticed to a painter when I was about 7 years old.
Wow.
An old painter called Abel Renault, who was an engraver for Fujita and for Salvador Dali.
Oh my gosh.
Was a personal engraver. But before that, he had done comics in World War I. So he had these early comics. And I was the only kid in the studio, and I had my comics project. So that was part of my formative time. And then I just kept at it. I mean, there was all kinds of projects all the time, you know, at every step of my life. And then I came back to the States. I was born in the States, but I had left when I was a few months old. And then I came back for college. And there I studied creative writing and fine arts again. So it was still those two passions.
Yeah.
And then I got going that way. And for a while I was working as a designer. Then I got into publishing when I moved to New York as a designer. And then soon after that, I got my first break in picture books, and that was the start of, you know, leading these two lives of, like, on the one hand, my own projects, and then on the other, moving increasingly into the editorial side, and eventually I got a chance to run it, my own imprint inside of Macmillan, which is for second books, and that's dedicated to graphic novels.
Yeah.
And
wow,
I get to publish some of the greatest talents in the world, you know, and so that's very exciting. And First Second is, you know, I think of it, you know, there's a business there, and of course it needs to be a successful business for it to be viable, but it's also, it's one of my babies. It's a project, you know, it's, in a sense, it's an art project as well.
Yeah. When you came back to the States for college, did your parents come with you, or did they stay
in
France?
No, my family's still in France. They're,
wow,
they're over there, and I have my brother lives here, but it was a weird thing because I grew up, I was kind of the American in the school, and then I came here and I was the Frenchie because I really didn't have all the references people had, you know, from growing up in the States.
Yeah, but you're bilingual. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's great. That is great. So do you remember your actually first paying gig that you had when you were here in the States, or?
I did a few little editorial illustration pieces that I wouldn't really want to show to anybody. I did some, at one point I was starting into doing some license work for some Nickelodeon books and things, but it was like very much in fits and starts. And then, you know, I was for about, when I lived in Boston after college, and I was for about 10 years getting just rejection letters on all my projects, and I was submitting stuff across the ocean as well to some French comics people. And then I was trying to break into picture books in America, and I just got so many rejections at a certain point I thought it was just going to be my lot in life, and I was just kind of settling to that.
Yeah.
And then I started working as a day job at first, really, as a designer at Simon & Schuster. And then about a year later, I had my first picture book deal with a great editor called Dick Jackson.
Yeah.
Who did Chris Roschka and Judy Blume, and who's kind of legendary in the business.
What a diverse background you have. That's great. That's great. Well, let's talk about then some of your previous works, somewhat recent, I guess, leading up to today. Like, you've got Sea Dogs, An Epic Ocean Operetta, Long Night Moon, which I'd like to talk about later as well, and Moving House.
Yeah.
Are any of those... It's kind of a lame question because it's like, well, which one was your favorite? But do any of those stand out in your mind?
Well, Sea Dogs was my first break, you know, so that was, and the spirit of that, it was kind of an amazing thing because this editor that I mentioned had seen a little comic I had done, which an art director I knew just showed him on her own volition. And so he knew I was doing comics, and it was like a little self-schooling project, you know, that I don't think I'll ever see the light of day, but he saw it, and that opened that door. And then he had this script for this book, Sea Dogs, by Lisa Wheeler. And it was a picture book, but it was basically an operetta, sort of like Gilbert and Sullivan, set in a dog's world. And he showed up one day, Richard Jackson, and he just put this on my desk and said, "Hey, do you want to do Tintin on this?"
Hmm.
Which was kind of a dream moment for me.
Yeah.
And then, so then we got into this, and I did it, even though it was very much in the picture book world, it was an experiment in kind of slipping some, a bit of European-style comics into the picture book format. And it was incredible fun. I mean, the spirit that went into it was really wild and kind of cutting loose. And I'd be, you know, I'd have phone calls with Dick Jackson at all hours of the night, and we'd just exchange bad dog puns and stick them into the book. And but I really had fun, and I feel like that got into the book. And then what was cool was at that moment, you know, all the big publishing houses were angling on the graphic novel and wondering what to do, trying to figure out how to position themselves with respect to the graphic novel, partly owing to the manga explosion and the fact that so much money was changing hands, and all the houses were wondering, you know, how to get a piece of that pie. So this book came out, and then it won the Blue Bonnet, the Texas Blue Bonnet, which was a big deal, and that was, you know, right at that moment when comics were on people's radar.
Mm-hmm.
So I got some attention that way. I was starting to dip into editorial. At Simon & Schuster, I acquired Jean Sfar's Little Vampire Goes to School and translated it, and that got onto the New York Times bestseller list, so that was also attention-getting. And then I continued. I had about four projects with Simon & Schuster that were picture books, but one of them was also a comic, a book I did with my wife, Sienna, called To Dance.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a kind of definitely a departure in style for me, because I had been doing these kind of cartoony doggy things. And here I was doing 10 years of her life in ballet at the School of American Ballet,
mm-hmm.
In the days when George Balanchine was running it. So it's like a piece of ballet history, and it's really for like 8, 9, 10-year-old girls, but in comics, you know, so, and in a loose style. And I was way outside my comfort zone. But that one is especially dear to me because it's still going strong, and it's really kind of found a place out there for a lot of people, a lot of librarians, but a lot of readers. And even though now I see, you know, countless flaws in it and the clumsiness of it, it's still, I feel like emotionally it tapped something in about 3 or 4 scenes.
Yeah,
I'm still proud of.
You'll be your own worst critic. It's always that way, you know.
Yeah, hopefully.
But how was it like?
So then it continued. Basically, you know, I did these other picture books, Long Night Moon with Cynthia Ryland, who's a great, great author. I did another one, Boogie Nights, again with Lisa Wheeler. That was optioned by DreamWorks Animation. Mm-hmm. And then my first picture book solo, writing and drawing, was Moving House with Roaring Brook Press, and that one combines a bit of comics, a bit of animation, and a bit of illustration sensibilities.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, after looking at Long Night Moon, I guess I need to backtrack a little bit, because I did not read, and I did this intentionally, I did not read the entire graphic novel of Taylor Swain on your site, whatever. I did that intentionally because I really want to read the book.
Right.
When it comes out. So I got into it like the first, I had a buddy that told me about it, said, you need to go to the site, check it out. You're going to love the style of art.
Uh-huh.
So I looked at the first 10 or so pages and I'm like, okay, I'm loving this, but I'm going to back off and wait. But I noticed when I looked at Long Night Moon,
yeah,
and some of your other books, but Long Night Moon looked like one of the first ones where you started to get into the charcoals or pastels.
That's right.
Is that correct?
Right. Yep. Yeah, Long Night Moon was it's a beautiful manuscript. It's a very poetic manuscript about the full moons of the year, kind of inspired from Native American traditions of naming the moons. And I really fell in love with the manuscript. And then I was doing it. At first, I did it in this kind of acrylics, and I tried different things. And then one day, just I don't even remember how it happened, but I was doodling with a little piece of charcoal, and then suddenly there's this glowing moon and this wintry, snowy landscape that appears before me, and I go like, okay, that's the mood for this thing. So I had fun doing that. And that one, what I did was these big charcoal drawings that I scanned and then worked in digital color. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to just create a mood that I enjoyed working that way. And then with Sailor Twain, when I came back around to Sailor Twain, I had done about 30 pages in ink and not really having fun with it. And I wasn't very happy with the overall atmosphere. And then again, you know, I think somebody actually suggested I try charcoal. And the whole thing is set in this 1880s New York on the Hudson River. It's always raining.
Love
it's like, you know, mist and fog and steam power and cold dust everywhere. You know, so it was just like this kind of perfect medium for it. But it's hard. It's hard to do. I mean, in some ways it's very forgiving, but in other ways it's a hard medium for comics because it's messy and you have to work big or you can't really get good detail.
Detail, yeah.
And then the scanning is a mess, you know, but, you know, I figured it out. It's like I had to scan it in plastic sleeves and stuff. But
yeah,
it was great.
I was going to ask you that. Definitely was going to ask you about your process there because I'm thinking, okay, how did he handle the traditional mess of dealing with charcoal?
That's right. Yeah, no, I had to figure that one out. But I was so sure, you know, I had to find a way to make it work because it was exactly the mood I wanted. And charcoal, in some ways, is very forgiving. The beauty of charcoal is that you can really work something up and you know, really render it and shade everything. But you can also just hint at something and suggest a steamboat in the fog.
Yep.
With just a little hint of something in it. So it was playing both ways.
It's a perfect fit for what for Sailor Twain really is. And especially when in the beginning you're taking us to the Ferryman's Tavern.
Yes.
And it's just like, oh my God, this is so perfect. So I'm looking at it going, this is great. I'm thinking, 'cause I love charcoal too, but I'm like, how, and I've always wondered, how would I translate that into, like, some kind of comic?
Yeah,
you know?
No, it's not obvious. It's not so obvious. I mean, some people have done it, but this was like I had to explore that a little bit to get it to work, you know, and I would use a lot of masking tape so I could keep the outside of the panels clean. I would mask the bubbles, you know, and cut out, like, artist tape and stuff, you know, to make the balloons. But then it actually got to be a pretty fast process, you know, and I would work... my thumbnails, I would draw, I basically composed the pages after I'd written the script. I would kind of rework it at thumbnail stage, and I would do that everywhere, in the train, on the bus, you know, in a cafe, like I could do that in small. And then I would do my pencils, also pretty small. They were like, you know, the size of a big notebook, basically. And then what I would do is go back to my studio and project my pencil onto a big sheet of watercolor paper. And then I'd do all my masking and I was working standing up, which helps with big pages and with charcoal.
Yeah.
And then I would, that was my early mornings, you know, and then I would kind of have to hop in the shower and scrub my hands, scrub all the black dust and then go to work.
Have you seen the, kind of off topic, but have you seen, they've got, I guess they're color tinted charcoal sticks.
Oh yeah,
and I don't know if you've tried them or not. If they're any good, I've been tempted, but I'm like, you know what? I'm just not sure yet.
I haven't really played with that. I mean, I've played with pastel, obviously, and I've played with like sanguine, you know, which is the reddish kind. But I haven't really. And with Sailor Twain, it was obviously from the beginning it was going to be in black and white, so you know, it was going to be all in shades of gray.
Well, tell us about the fact that you did this. You started this as a web comic, right? So did you find it advantageous to have that immediate feedback from the readers as you gradually went along in development here?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary adventure, doing the web comic thing. And I set out, initially it was really just going to be a book, but I had in mind like the 19th century tradition of serialized novels. You know, all the great 19th century writers were serializing first, you know, Melville and Dickens and Harriet Beecher Stowe. I mean, there's all these different, you know, great books that we know that first came out in serial installments. And I didn't know that much about the webcomic scene, and I kind of got an education on that along the way. But the thought was, like, a little bit in that tradition, that old 19th century tradition to just try and serialize it online. And I really had no idea if anybody was going to come along for the ride, because it's like, you know, it's pretty slow building at first, and it's like this 19th century plot, you know, so it's dense and there's these three interwoven love stories. It's like five chapters before you even see the mermaid, you know, it's like it basically doesn't start off with a big bang and explosions and stuff. Well, a couple of explosions.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it was an experiment, and I was basically prepared to just drop the whole thing after a few months if it didn't work. And in the meantime, I was learning about what webcomics were like out there and the kinds of numbers of readers that the successful ones get. It's phenomenal. You know,
yeah.
When like Kate Beaton and OrexKCD, like these, you know, they count their hits in the millions. And with Sailor Twain, it really did take off. I mean, there were people who were all different kinds of readers. I mean, some people were history buffs. Some people were like Jane Austen kind of readers. A lot of women, a lot of students, and then some oddball like steamboat geeks and, you know, all different kinds. And so, yeah, the interaction was the most amazing thing at first, to just have that. I was about 50 pages ahead of what I was putting up online, and I had my story worked out before I launched. But it was like, you know, I could tell from the feedback, you could tell right away if a scene didn't quite hit the mark, you know, like are they asking
right.
the wrong questions or something, and you just go, okay. So in the end, there were only really two scenes that I redid after it was all done, because I felt like they were key scenes and they needed to really be their best. And then I redid a bunch of faces and little inconsistencies, but mostly, you know, I didn't change it fundamentally. What I did change from the interaction was occasionally some of the steamboat geeks and the history geeks would point out a detail that was off, you know, like maybe a fashion thing that was wrong, or or sometimes even like the slats of wood in the captain's cabin were too wide for an 1880s steamboat, you know, so I would go back.
Incredible.
Yeah, like really specific stuff. But then, and amazing surprises happened along the way from doing that would never have happened if I'd just done a book where it was like, like a scholar.
Yeah.
There's a teacher up in at Vassar in Poughkeepsie on the Hudson River who sent me poetry from the 19th century about the river, stuff like that, you know, that was kind of woven into the blog along the way.
And I think which another thing that stood out, which I read somewheres, which I thought was just totally genius, is that you actually characterized some of the fans in the book and put some characters
in
there with their faces.
The cameos, that was also one of those things that just happened, you know, from doing the webcomic that I wouldn't have predicted, you know, in 1,000 years beforehand. But it was one of those times that I was just working on a crowd scene. There was like a ballroom, it's a ball on board the ship. And I had a lot of people to draw, and I said, you know, hey guys, if you want to send me a photo, I can put you in Victorian fashion on board the ship. You can have a cameo appearance. And it was like 75 of them appeared right then and there. And then it was like, they just kept coming. Even after I was all done, I still get the odd photo from somebody, you know, asking to be in the story. And so there's about 100 faces in there that are real people.
And the fact that you intertwine so much factual history with your story, and all that research that I'm sure you had to do building up to that, how much time passed from the time you started the research till you started to really write it down and translate it onto paper in finished form?
Well, it was about...
Are we talking like months?
No, it was years. I mean, the whole thing, the whole project has been about 9 years process. And, you know, I would say the first 4 years were really divided between a very intensive working and reworking the script, which was a working script that ended up changing quite a lot as I put it down into pictures. But then I had that working script. I would say the time was divided between that and the research, and I was, you know, getting to know first name basis people at the New York Public Library and the New York Historical Society and other little historical societies along the Hudson. And I got a ton of stuff, you know, most of which doesn't directly go into the story. So I used some of that for the blog, which was also a draw, you know, because there were people who were just interested in Hudson history and stuff. And that was very exciting, you know, but I collected a lot of stuff. And for me, the history part, I mean, I love history. I love historical novels. I love historical movies. And I enjoy researching history. But in this case, it was really used and abused in a selfish way, because I was doing everything I could to just anchor the reader in that time, you know, and build the credibility around something that's basically hard to believe, you know, supernatural for Romans.
Right. So. Interesting. Now, I guess one of the most obvious questions that a lot of people would probably have is, why the Hudson River? What? How did that start? What prompted you to say, you know, I want to write a book about, you know, during this, the Victorian era, and Hudson River? What was there something that you loved about the Hudson River earlier?
There's been, I mean, since I moved to New York, I've had a love affair with it. Our first apartment was overlooking, I could see the Hudson from my little drawing desk. So I was kind of basking in it. And then in my commute to work, you know, I work in Manhattan, and I live in one of the river towns in Westchester, and I would take the train down to Manhattan every day along the Hudson, you know, and I would see these amazing, this big rock wall called the Palisades on the New Jersey side, you know, and it was just this enchanting thing. And so I was, and while I was doing this, I was dreaming up the story, and the layers were appearing, and, you know, so I was like, when I was looking out the window, I was in my mind, I was seeing steamboats, I was seeing sailboats, I was seeing this mermaid, you know, telling me a story. So it came out definitely a love affair with the Hudson, and I got to know more of the Hudson further north as I was researching, and it's definitely deepened into this. You know, it is. It's a love letter to the Hudson in part. The story is, but. And then what's funny is I got connected up because of the webcomic. I connected up with a lot of the Hudson Valley people. There's a winery that's like an award-winning winemaker up in Millbrook. The Millbrook winery. They put out two Sailor Twain wines, which was great.
Really?
I got to do wine labels, which I've always wanted to do. I got connected up with there's this ship. There's this beautiful sloop that people see on the river. Called the Clearwater, which is Pete Seeger created, and it's the emblem of the Hudson, and it's like an environmental mission to clean up the river, and he even forced a big corporation to fork up over $1 billion to clean up the pollution in the river. And then one day I got a call from those people saying, like, you know, we've all been reading Sailor Twain. And in fact, the Clearwater is in the store. I mean, you see it a couple times on the river. But they called and they said, you know, we'd like to offer you the boat for an evening to do a Sailor Twain sunset sail. And so we did that with the wine, with food, and with music, and it was just this unforgettable evening. And we're doing another one right at the book launch on October 5th. So, I mean, fun stuff like that, you know, it's just like totally impossible to predict stuff like that happening.
Yeah. It's amazing how it just kind of...
It just spilled over into reality.
That's incredible. That's great. Now, we were talking about, you know, all the processes you had to go through with working with charcoal and stuff. A lot of people may wonder, okay, well, why not just do it digitally? You can emulate charcoal drawing, whatever. Do you have any regrets, or are you glad you did it traditionally?
No, no regrets. Definitely no regrets. No, and I felt like this needed to be done without shortcuts. You know, the lettering is also done with, it's not charcoal, it's a greasy pencil. But, it's all done. It's all, the pages are pretty much as they are. You know, there was a little bit of digital cleanup, like, because I realized after I scanned them that I couldn't do right angles to save my life. So I had to tweak some panels just to keep things straight, you know, but other than that, you know, I felt like it needed to be the actual piece, you know, had to exist physically. And there are some great people doing stuff directly in digital. who I really admire. But I feel like, for me, the tactile experience, you know, of putting it down and the accidents that happen and the kind of, you know, there's something about that that I think is impossible to duplicate. So no
regrets. I have a I have a motion tablet that I use a lot for sketching.
I'll
tell you what, when it comes to when I get back to my old drawing board, there's nothing like that tactile feeling. Yeah. It's hard to, you know. Of course, I'm 40. I'm 48.
Yeah, so. We're in that generation where it's like, you know, we still like our books physical, you know. But I mean, I think there's something, you know, I think there is a quality that people can feel at the end result that's pretty unique. You know, that it's like.
Oh, yeah. Now, I guess this question leads right into the next, which is, you've done all this traditionally. Now, where are all these originals, and are you going to be selling some, or is that something that you're just going to hang on to?
Yeah, a couple of people bought, there's been two that were sold, but I've held back because there's this New York Public Library Sailor Twain exhibit that opens at the end of October, October 25th. It's in the old maps division. It's awesome. It's going to mix original pages with old maps and some of the research reference from the archives. And what's awesome is that they're treating the events of Sailor Twain as historical fact inside the exhibit. So it's going to be really fun, and that's coming. There's also going to be an exhibit at the Mark Twain House in Connecticut. So after that, you know, I don't know if I'm going to sell them or not. I'm not sure, but they're, you know, I had to hold those for the exhibits.
Oh yeah, but it's nice to know you have that possible money making
opportunity
down the road.
Yeah. Now I know some people make a handsome living selling their originals. I don't know, you know, if it would work with these, but
yeah, I don't know. I think I'd love to have some just from the few pages I looked at. I'm like, oh, these are great.
Thanks.
But I don't know. But then in some of the stuff I've done in my past, it's not nearly to the scale of what you've done, but I kind of get attached. I don't know how to explain it. It's
yeah, sure. You live with your characters. You get to know them.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, for me, there's a part of, in general, with projects, I tend to feel like I finish a project and it's like a shedding. And, you know, and what interests me is the next project, you know, and I feel like, mm-hmm. okay, that I got out of myself in a way. And, you know, hopefully I basically gave it my best, and you know, now I'm in a position to make the next attempt better, but it tends to be that way to me. So I'm less attached to the pieces than if I felt like, you know, oh, this is a gem, and I would want to have it in my home or something.
Yeah, way better off that way, to be able to release and let it go. I did notice something that's kind of made me laugh, because I don't know why it just reminded me of, you know, when I used to watch the old Jay Ward, Bullwinkle shows, they had two titles, you know. You did the same thing. Was that something that was something you were going to do from the start, something conscious, or you just...
Yeah, the title was always there. The title never changed, funny enough. But and it was always a subtitle, you know. Sailor Twain was the main title, or The Mermaid and the Hudson. Yeah. I like that. I like the double title. I like the 19th century long titles, you know, like The Strange Case of Dr. Mm-hmm. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and, you know. there's a tradition of having these things where you get like a kind of a simple hook of a title, and then something that gives you a little more to hang on to.
Oh yeah, just a little more to it than just you know, one or two words, whatever. I love that. I love that so much. Now, did any of your family members or the personalities or mannerisms from them find their way into your cast of characters in your story at all in Sailor Twain or not?
Not hugely. I mean, by the time I was working and reworking the dialogue and the characters and getting to know them, you know, the springboard for the characters were at first voices in my own head and sometimes a little bit of people I knew, but not, you know, not for long. It felt like the characters quickly became their own voices. And, you know, there is a dynamic in there that I feel does draw from my own family experience. There's a great love between two brothers in the story, you know, and one of them disappears, and there's this grief about that, and you know, and I drew a little bit from the kind of the friendship that's grown between my brother and me, You know, there were things like that. So it was not, never directly plucking things or, you know, plucking words out of my parents' mouth. And I mean, there's things like, you know, Twain has a very domineering father who doesn't support his artistic passion, because Twain is a bit of a poet and an artist at heart who ended up being a captain, and his father really wanted him to be in West Point like his older brother. That's not at all the case with me. I was lucky to have very, very supportive parents.
Yeah.
There, now it's on the record.
I'm sure you don't have anybody. Yeah. I'm sure you don't have anybody like Lafayette.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, Lafayette, the thing with Twain and Lafayette is that you have, you know, Captain Twain, no relation to Mark Twain, as he likes to grumble, you know, when people ask him if he's related. Yeah. But he's American, and Lafayette is French. And the two of them are, you know, their arcs, they're, in a way, their emotional story arcs, their moral arcs kind of cross over each other. Mm-hmm. They pass by each other. And so you have one is like this very Anglo-Saxon morality, in a way, and then the other one is more the Latin morality, or lack thereof, you know, you might say, from this side of the ocean. But it's like, you know, they basically have these two world views that belong a little bit with my two genetics, in a sense, you know, my two, you know, the two streams running in my own blood. So I was playing with that, you know, I was playing with those two sides, playing them a bit against each other and just taking them to their conclusion. You know, Lafayette is basically a very upstanding, a bit of a Puritan ethic, you know, but, and the way he's drawn, you know, he's more cartoony and he's a bit more black and white. Whereas Lafayette is all shades of gray, and he's, at first he's the libertine, he's the cad, and he's got like seven loves going on, and you don't really know why he's doing this, but, you know, it turns out there's a reason, and then where the story takes him is quite different than where the story takes Twain.
Yeah, no, the small amount that I've looked at, it looks like it's going to build up to be something really, really interesting.
Thanks.
So I will be getting that book. Now, is there any advice that you could give to, like, you know, some aspiring graphic novelists or cartoonists that are looking to develop a project similar as far as, like, building it around historical facts? I mean, are there certain places you would tell them to go first, or just...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think the path each of us takes is in some ways very unique to each of us, and then I think there's certain milestones you kind of have to cross with any project, and especially if you're ambitious with your project and you're, you know, you want to build something that hopefully people will read and reread, you know, and that it can stand the test of time. I think with history stuff, the trick, what I ran up against was you can fall prey to your own homework, in a sense, and you can want to show off your research, and that happens in novels as well, and sometimes even movies, although movies, they tend to not do enough research sometimes, but you know, you get like, oh, here's the little history lesson tacked into the thing, and I really tried to strip, that was in the script for a while, you know, I had some of that stuff, it was like, oh, here's some, you know, goodies about the Hudson, about New York in 1887, this, that, the other, and I ended up cutting all of that out, you know, and I left the bits that are there that give you the context of the times and are there because they belong with the story. And then I think everything else, a lot of the research, I think the thing to know is that, you know, if you look at the great historians and great historical fiction writers like David McCullough and Colleen McCullough, and they tend to have done a lot of work, but it serves to just imbue everything with a sense of place and time, you know, but it doesn't detract from the human story. And I think that's an important thing to consider. The other thing I think is, you know, in general with people starting out with graphic novels and starting out with their own projects, specifically with like a long comic form project, I think a lot of people cut corners in the in the prep work. And I think the prep, it's a bit like, you know, if you're painting a house or something, it's only going to be as good as your prep. And starting a project, starting those actual finished pages too soon is a mistake I think that's often made. And it's hard, obviously, for people, you know, to find the time, and especially if they don't have an advance, or if they're working on something just on spec, you know, the temptation to get to get to the fruit right away is huge, right. You know. And I think that the great stuff, the stuff I see to be really, really the most worthwhile, has, like, there's a whole loom of stuff that's been built up before the person sets out to do that first panel, you know, where they've developed. And it's not just the historical research, because that's setting, but it's also the characters, getting to really, really know from the inside your characters, so that when they take that stage, you know, I mean, when you see any good storyteller, I think you get a feeling that a character makes an entrance and exists right then and there. And that's also a lot of unseen homework done, you know. And there's all methods, there's all different kinds of methods about, you know, doing backstories and all this stuff. I don't think there's one key, but I think it's having given a lot of thought to a character, and also a character's arc and the character's transformation in the course of the story, I think is part of what makes things great. More than, you know, sometimes more than the dazzling artistry. I think that background stuff makes a huge difference, at least for me as a reader. You know, when I'm really taken in by a story and I'm really drawn, and it becomes a part of my life, the experience of reading it, I tend to find that the characters have surprising dimensions, you know.
Yes, definitely. That's great advice. Great advice.
And also, you know, I think, you know, looking for examples of that everywhere you can is helpful. You know, there's some great writing happening collectively in TV. You know, like the TV miniseries. When you look at the craft of Mad Men or Game of Thrones, or even an animated series like Avatar: Last Airbender, you know, there's a richness, there's feeling, and there's meaning behind it. You know, where you feel like it's been pushed far enough to become something very compelling. You know, and people then wonder, well, how did they do that? How do they surprise me that way with this character? Why do I keep being compelled, you know, to follow what this character is doing, even though he's an asshole or something? You know, like, you know, this kind of thing. I think that it doesn't happen by accident. I think it happens because of having done the right preparation.
You know, I've even gone back and looked at, of course, again, kind of revealing my age, I've gone back and looked at some old sitcoms, like from the 60s and 50s, and there'll be some character that's kind of just plain, but yet you always want to go back, and you want to follow that character's life, and you're like, why? How did they do that? You know, they didn't. There's no razzle dazzle there, but they, you know, there's something there that makes you want to come back.
Yeah, I mean, I love that stuff. To me, it's like, you know, in a way, I think if you're doing your own projects, you're a student of those things, you know, and you're kind of looking for the clues and figuring out, like, how do they do it, you know? So you don't enjoy them the same way as most people, maybe, you know, a little bit like the painter going to the museum, you know, instead of standing back and admiring the Monet lilies, you know, he's like, he's got his nose right up to the paint, and he's like trying to see, you know, what size the brush strokes were, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's, I don't know, I think that's really interesting, really interesting. Well, I know, obviously, 9+ years for Sailor Twain, that's a lot of time. Are you, what's next on the horizon for you? Are you just taking a breather now, going to enjoy some of this?
Oh, no.
You know, when the book gets
released? No, no. I mean, one thing I've learned along the way was I don't want to cool off. I don't want to get cold. You know, and once you're warm and once you have some momentum, I think that's pretty sacred. And so I have a few things cooking. There's some various projects, is a picture book and a couple things that are taking up that space now.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Mark, and I've got another special guest coming up for the fall that I hope you'll enjoy equally as well. Mark Siegel's work as well as Sailor Twain can be viewed online at sailortwain.com. That's sailortwain, T-W-A-I-N.com. Sailor Twain, the graphic novel, is due to be released on October 5th as of this recording and will be available at many booksellers nearest you. Bruce Rosenberger's Comics Cast podcast can be accessed at Comics Cast, that's Comics Cast with a K, O-M-I-C-S-K-A-S-T dot Libsyn, that's L-I-B-S-Y-N dot com, and it's a good podcast. You need to go check it out. They're not real long, but they're insightful, and they've got a lot of good information about comic books as well as small press books and many other, you know, related items pertaining to the comic genre. My website, however, is accessible at togostudios.com, and really there's not a lot there right now. It's kind of being refreshed, and if you go there, there's really not much there right now. But it is there, and it is, again, togostudios.com. Thank you so much for listening. I hear the closing music starting to come in, which can only mean one thing. It's time for me to go out. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. I will talk to you all soon, and hopefully we'll get back together this fall within the next month or two. Signing out. Dad, if you're up there listening, this one's for you. Take care, everyone. So long.
I like the fruit flavor of Trix. I like the fruit flavor of Trix. I like the fruit flavor of Trix.
But Trix are meant for kids. Yes, sir. Trix are for you. It's the corn cereal with fruit flavor goodness.
Fruit colors, too.
So try Trix.
Hey, Aki, what you doing?
Learning to fly.
How to succeed at flying without really trying?
I want to be historic, like my ancestors.
Why fly? Have some cornflakes.
Look.
Leonardo the Yaki, inventor of the viaduct, the aqueduct, and the first lighter-than-air duct?
Yeah, my great-grandfather. And look, Wilbur and Oliver Yak, pioneers of modern flight.
Hey, that's right.
I have to fly. My destiny.
Little duck, you haven't got the strength for it. Why don't you tank up with some of my Kellogg's Corn Flakes? Crip's delicious cereal.
You talked me into it.
Hey, watch it. You're getting aerodynamically impossible.
That ought to do it.
Well, at least he was wearing his light fall suit.